The difficulty arises because tradition looks for concrete beginnings to human evolution, whereas the beginning, if you can use such a word in relation to the infinite, rests upon spiritual factors. There was emergence of the spiritual into the physical, not only of man but of his whole environment, the descent of an infinite concept into a finite. At no point could you say that the spiritual ended and the material began, but at least you can say this, that in the cold, rational theories of evolution there can be no sort of meaning at all, while in the real story of the earth meaning shines out with the promise, nay the certainty, of a glorious fulfillment. It is for this reason that you have to live, at present, largely by faith. I promised Zeros that I would ponder the whole subject before committing myself to paper. I realized then, as I still do, that truth must be allowed to speak for itself. We cannot hope to defend it by theoretical argument. But I am convinced that there is something within us that will respond to truths which cannot be couched in words. Time and time again, during our visits through time and space, and also as a cardinal point in his discourses, Zeros reiterated the need to recall the universality of man, which he held to be the key to understanding. As you hold that man is an isolated individual, responsible only for his own integrity and capable of achieving the ultimate aim of his existence by his own efforts, so long must you flounder in a muddy sea of conjecture. But once you can instill into your consciousness that mankind is a homogeneous whole, then many problems are resolved. It is natural that man should cling unduly to his personality, that he should identify himself too much with his physical being, but neither of these is immortal. The personality can change in a single lifetime, through an operation or through some deep emotional experience. Your personality is not what it was when you were a child. The fruits of experience are found in the personality, but the goodness of those fruits, or otherwise, is absorbed by what you could better term the individuality, a much more permanent attribute of the spirit. The personality may not long survive the dissolution of the body, but the individuality of the spirit goes on and on. This idea of unity in diversity is the principle of creation, for after all, if God created all there is, every diverse manifestation of that creation can be traced back to the one source. A grain of sand is but a concourse of atoms, vibrant with the Creator's life, manifested for a purpose, the same life which is your life. But you must not think that thereby you will someday lose your identity and be swallowed up in the primal essence. There can be no ending of the essential you, for there are no such limitations in eternal life. But as you progress, you will learn so to surrender your free will to the will of God through the utter longing of your whole being to be part of Him, that any idea of separation would be anathema to you. That is the best I can do to present the infinite in finite terms. But it is very important to try and encompass the idea with your understanding. I should like to describe what we saw of these early men, though that too is difficult. In the still slightly ethereal environment in which they found themselves, they seemed solid enough, but they bore little resemblance to the more backward races we know today. They were enormous in stature and hirsute in appearance, and they wore a puzzled, vacant stare as if they found their surroundings difficult to comprehend. They lived mainly on fruits and roots, not yet having learned to hunt animals for food. They were as far separated from any idea of divine creation as an empty shell is from a living crustacean. Clearly the greater part of their intelligence was in a state of torpor. They wandered about like lost souls. It was hard to believe that these poor creatures had once been glorious spiritual beings with incredible powers of creation. Such was the extent of their fall and such was the mercy of their Creator that they were given this comparatively easy way out of the pit into which they had fallen. Once more Zeros emphasized how in their fall from high estate, they had brought with them the terrible odor of perversion which had its baleful effect upon any environment in which they found themselves. But their lack of intelligence prevented them from manifesting it except unconsciously, through the natural functions of their crude bodies, with the cooperation of the elemental beings in the soil upon which they had their being, absorbing, transmuting, rectifying the chemical perversion which had been wrongly assembled. So, with infinite slowness, through endless generations during which these souls incarnated again and again, the upward climb began, as they were in some measure freed from the clinging miasma of their erstwhile sin. The urges engendered by the bifurcation of their souls strengthened the need to overcome their harsh environment, filling them with spiritual vitality as they became accustomed to their surroundings. The males fought and conquered a nature biased against them, while the females brought forth young in labor and pain. Together they learned the rudiments of family responsibility through the proddings of instinct. And between the two sexes there flashed the first gleams of human passion, the same pristine love they had once known but dragged down to the level on which they were now forced to live. While all this was happening, Azeros explained, the Adamic race was already beginning its errand of mercy, descending into incarnate life, but not yet of it, manifesting in forms not visible to the fallen race. With their superior intelligence they were able to lift the thoughts of the fallen ones and inspire them with something above the purely material. These were not yet capable of faith, but they could respond to its opposite, superstition, the other side of the penny, as it were. So gradually they became aware of a power outside of themselves, a factor enhanced by the terrestrial upheavals which still shook the cooling crust of Earth. And so began the system of worship, which has never been entirely lost through the ages. Naturally its early form was crude and inspired by fear, taking the form of propitiation. In time it crystallized into organized religion. The visiting entities, which later on became actually visible to them, were given names and attributes, and thus was born the pantheon of gods which illumine the mists of mythology, whose antics, pictured by contemporary minds, have so often amused later generations. Presently a desire to capture and possess such contacts, which made a great appeal to the dim understanding of these people, led them to erect stone cairns and monoliths at the places where these visitors were accustomed to manifest. In this way, it was felt, the entity could be worshipped whether actually visible or not. These were gradually enlarged and decorated, and given shelter from the elements, and thus the idea of church or temple grew. And all this time the process of passing through the defilement which was the cause of their situation, went on, entering the soil and being dissipated there. Who is to say whether they might not have attained their goal without further aid, but evidently divine prescience knew that the process could be speeded by the introduction of a fresh and undefiled race of beings, providing a new test of their spiritual strength, far greater than their struggles against natural forces, and without which they might have lost hope and stagnated into inertia. For they were destined to meet and merge with the Adamic race which was already incarnating into human bodies, though infinitely superior to those inhabited by the indigenous people of the earth. Already the Garden Beautiful was melting its environment onto the surface proper, perhaps because its pristine elegance had also been invaded by the perversion that was evident in the hardened crust below. It was becoming clear to me that there must be something very wonderful about man, for the Creator could so easily have destroyed this rebellious section of spiritual man and allowed the remainder to grow in his purpose and design unhindered by this defection. There must be something in man which even he could not destroy, because it was part of himself. And because he was love itself, he could only go on loving that which had sought relief in the illusory fastnesses of its own mentality. There could be no reality in the material life these people encountered, because it was so much less than good, so out of touch with divine creative beauty. So was born in me the conviction that man is a spiritual being in reality, the only part of him that really matters, that really is immortal, that never began and could never end. And the sense life he leads is so ineffectual because it has no real meaning beyond being a stepping stone to a life beyond his imagination. And as he rises to this understanding, so must his environment rise too, for it has fallen into materiality only to match his own fallen nature, held in that state only by the merciful will of the Creator who cannot fail and whose love will not let him go. I cannot resist a sigh of peace and happiness at this revelation of the purpose of the earth's destiny. How petty and transient all its material problems become when one views the prospect from this wide perspective. How infinite the love of the Father, While the measureless descent of the fallen race can be made the yardstick of the extent to which man, and his environment, can and must rise. Above all, the terrible thought of divine injustice which clogs the understanding of so many seekers after truth, was utterly annihilated. I began to see the Creator in a new light, one that was almost frightening in its immeasurable intensity. All this and much more Zeros explained to me, emphasizing the main features by actual visits to these primeval scenes. One vivid experience I call to mind. We were standing on a rocky headland looking out over a vast forest of strange, fern-like trees, immensely high. There is something rather peculiar and terrifying about primeval life. One is so close to raw nature and primitive instincts, and we found a very definite aroma of, what shall I call it, evil intelligence, in the atmosphere. It might have been the dark undergrowth with its hints of forbidden things, but I had an unmistakable feeling that in this seemingly peaceful scene evil lurked. I was sure of it. Zeros told me that it was because I was sensitive to the perverted creative forces which had to be employed to produce a living space in which perverted humanity might seek its release. Suddenly we were startled by a low vibrant murmur. It seemed to come from the air as if a great fleet of menacing bombers was approaching. We looked up expectantly as the sound increased. The harsh vibrations grew to a rhythmic roar, and a moment later, over the tops of the trees, came an enormous aerial reptile. I simply could not call it a bird. As it threshed its horrid way towards us, I could see it was colossal in size. It had a scaly body which shone with a sickening sort of oily iridescence. Its feet hung down, terminating in huge talons, while its yawning beak displayed rows of vicious teeth. Clearly a carnivorous beast. The monstrous head yawed this way and that, as if seeking for prey. There was nothing of animal grace in any of its movements. For one ghastly moment it seemed as if our eyes met. Its baleful gaze, cold and hateful, caught and held my fascinated stare. There was something utterly cruel and malignant behind those soulless eyes. It was evil incarnate, and the beast carried with it the stench of putrefaction. The thing passed above us and threshed its ponderous way onwards towards the horizon, uttering tremendous croaks that echoed over the forest. I turned and faced Zeros, horror in my eyes. His face held a look of infinite compassion as he answered my unspoken query. Ayo, that creature was not deliberately created by God, but because of the wholesale perversion of the earthly environment by the sinful souls imprisoned in its astral surround, every attempt to create in terms of perfection was of necessity frustrated. The evil flocculence had to be got rid of through physical means. That was the only way. That is why the early animal life and vegetation was monstrous in size and a denial of the goodness of God. It had its purpose and fulfilled it. By passing much of this evil vibration through into the rectifying processes of the earth. As these animals lived and died, they deposited in the soil their excrement and in the end, their bodies. The very chemicals of the soil were planned by omniscient mind for just this purpose, that they might purify and reconstitute all the poisonous matter consigned to their operations. In this the tiny bacterial life played its part. Do you not see that even in your day when you putrefying matter to the soil in the form of manure, in a short time it is rendered wholesome and fit to speed the growth of your food? Do not judge these animals, for they also served their God. A Chapter 8, Lemuria. Many attempts have been made to establish the locality and proofs of the existence of this fabled continent, said to have been situated in the Pacific, but with little impact on scientific beliefs and geological evidences. The fact is that Lemuria, more than any other part of the Earth's crust, had an existence more in the ethereal than in the physical. Zeros had tried to explain to me how the Garden Beautiful literally melted into a physical condition, a whole realm descending into material constituency. I am fully aware how difficult many must find this to accept, especially if they have any idea of geological formations and prehistoric events. We must just accept that unacceptability as evidence of how far we are from any real understanding of our true nature and that of the seemingly solid world in which we live. Our knowledge of the atomic theory has done much to explode our medieval notions of the nature of matter, but tradition and inhibited ideas die hard. In Lemuria we have to deal with an admixture of races, where the ascending race was making rapid progress along material lines, and the descent to their rescue of the Adamic race which was already coming under the dark spell of a people whose intellect was growing sufficiently to enable some memory of their past to invade their consciousness, bringing with it age-old desires for experiment, for conquest, for some expression of the great powers they once possessed. The task of the Adamic ones was to lift this consciousness as far above the mundane as possible so as to prevent the returning knowledge from being put to evil uses. This they did educationally and by the example they demonstrated to the inferior race. To these the Shining Ones from a spiritual world must have seemed as the saints do to us in our day. For not only were they beautiful by contrast but they held their clairvoyant powers and their innate wisdom. Some of them became priest kings, holding great respect and great power over the darker peoples. Thus the embryonic minds grew towards intellectuality, and became subject to reason rather than instinct. It was from this land that the legend of the third eye emanated, and in primordial carvings of gods and goddesses this organ is often depicted, located in the center of the forehead. It was never biologically visible, being present only in the etheric body of an advanced soul. But the progress was not constant or always upward. The symbolism of sacrifice often degenerated into blood sacrifice. The initial idea was that of the liberation of the spirit from the flesh, but the value of the offering soon took greater place in the minds of the celebrants than the mystical meaning. There is a deep psychic significance in the shedding of blood, lost to our materialistic understanding, which released considerable psychic power in those far-off days. Adepts soon realized this and employed these powers to impress the worshippers, thus gaining much power over them. Till finally, through a terrible perversion of the law of love, they found that by sacrifice of their most treasured possession, the eldest son, immense effects were produced. I had many glimpses of this rapidly developing race, increasing in numbers due to the steady rise in the standard of living. It is not easy to recall what I saw of this people nor of the earlier races, because of the somewhat ethereal nature of matter as then manifested. The world was still not quite physical in relation to our rate of vibration and so were the bodies of the people a little out of focus to my vision. It was because of the wholesale destruction of this continent by volcanic disturbance and subsidence that so little evidence remains of its erstwhile existence, though many feel that Easter Island holds the secret of its later culture. For the rest we have to rely upon myth and legend and certain geological characteristics for any proofs of its locality. The giant Lemurians built great cities of lava-like basalt, hewn by their great muscles into slabs beyond the capacity of modern brawn. Yet because it was then not so concrete as now the effort would not be so great. In China and Mongolia there are relics of unbelievable antiquity thought to be associated with these peoples, while the Polynesians are thought to be their direct descendants. In those days everything was proportionately bigger than what we are accustomed to, and the great size of buildings, etc., and the giant forms of vegetation may have given rise to more modern notions that size means greatness. As the seasons changed, the Lemurians responded with appropriate ritual and ceremony, thus marking their growing acknowledgement of divine rhythmic processes of creation. Slowly they were becoming aware of a great power outside of themselves to which recognition must be given. Generation by generation enlightenment grew as the process of reincarnation enabled the sinner-stained souls to seek rehabilitation in the remedial experience of earthly life. But as the intelligence of the incarnate souls grew so did the dim memory of their one-time creative knowledge emerge into their consciousness. And some were not slow to put this knowledge to evil use once again. Zeros assured me that this had been foreseen, it could not be helped. The race had to be redeemed even though some strove still to plunge it into fresh disaster. The indications were small at first, the self-confidence of a conqueror leading to overweening desire for power, the psychic powers of the priests giving them immense stranglehold over a superstitious people. Man had fallen through the misuse of his free will and only through his free will could he be brought back to the fold. So the infection had to be allowed to spread, even though it meant ultimate disaster to this particular civilization. Spiritual beings in charge of this doomed race strove mightily to keep the evil within bounds, but these efforts were as flames to the fires of eager desire. Soon nation fought nation for mastery, tribe fought tribe within the nations. Perversion and black alchemy were practiced until the situation deteriorated beyond hope. Destruction, which man has hitherto achieved in small ratio with gun and bomb, was exceeded many times by these powerful people. In considering the powers exercised by the Lemurians, Azeros put in, you have to remember the pliability of matter, unknown to your day. Moreover, although these people were not what you would call in a high state of industrial civilization, nevertheless they had power that you might envy. They had some degree of control over matter, mental control over atomic adhesion to which your materialists would never admit. Can you wonder that this degenerate civilization had to be destroyed because of the illicit expression of their knowledge, which was filtering back with their dawning intellect? Yet you may be sure that from the divine point of view nothing of value was lost. Millions of incarnations were cut short, but today death is not something to fear. It is release, promotion, a new phase of life and experience. All that was best in that continent was carried forward to a new existence by souls who remained true to their destiny. In the end, the unhappy land was riven by earthquakes and literally burnt out by volcanic action. Vast masses of land subsided during the lengthy period of this blasting of a continent, until eventually only pitiful remnants of a mighty race remained clinging desperately to mountain tops, which are now numbered among the new lands constituting the archipelagos between the land masses of Asia and Australia. Only the more advanced souls were inspired to emigrate, and under divine guidance these were led to new countries where it was intended that new light was to be fostered among indigenous inhabitants already forming the rudiments of a new civilization, one of the most famous in the history of the planet, the fabulous continent of Atlantis. Thus was consummated another fall of man. Already faded from earthly memory, it was a seeming triumph of evil over good. Yet quiet reflection shows that it was otherwise in the eyes of a loving father. An immense amount of original sin must have been dissipated through the growth and the struggles of the Lemurian peoples and also in the trembling foundations of the erupting soil. Though this might be counted as a setback if one thinks in terms of time and the incidence of physical death and disruption of family life, in reality there was unbroken progress, for life went on in other realms. The climb was but translated to other spheres of influence. Nothing of enduring value was lost, and much of no value at all was destroyed. Thus it happens in the disappearance of all the great civilizations from the broad face of the earth. Destiny plays its part amid the grim enactments, and the supreme love of God ensures that everything works together for good. It is only in our limited understanding that we can see loss in the fall of empires. Such was the lesson to be learned from the rise and fall of that great community, the land of Lemuria. Chapter 9, Atlantis. Those islands of the blessed, so far away. So far Zeros had given me glimpses of those two races of mankind, so divergent in condition and with such a different destiny, the one to rise after a cataclysmic fall, the other to descend on a divine mission of rescue. He now informed me that we were to witness the final emergence of the two races during the famed civilization of Atlantis. In what we have already seen, he observed, you will have discerned the utter goodness of what you term God, in his wonderful handling of the battle between the power of good and the chimera of evil, to which the fallen race had given itself. Yet all was accomplished without ever invading the secure territory of man's free will, his most precious gift from his Creator. For it is within the sanctuary of that free will that the Spirit of God dwells, the kingdom of God in man. It is only in separation from God that man is cut off from his own spirit in some degree, and instead of seeing freedom as the wondrous attribute of Godhead, he sees it as some alluring figment in which God plays no part. He is enmeshed in his own delusions. God's battle is won before ever it is joined, for on the one hand there is omnipotence and on the other delusion, only the veil of man's self-will is drawn between them. The battle is fought in the dimension of time, undimensionally it has no existence at all. It is as simple as that. It was a delicate operation which was undertaken in Atlantis. The descending race of Adamic peoples had spiritual power and some wisdom, but not great experience. The ascending race had experience latent in them but little spiritual expression. Now the two races were to meet and make an exchange, as it were, of their two attributes, from the one knowledge of how to live in the harsh conditions of incarnate life, and from the other how to express their own spiritual nature in all they experienced. On this vast continent we are about to visit, you will find the indigenous inhabitants, led to some extent by emigrants from Lemuria who had brought the fruits of that civilization with them, and among them there will be the incarnating race from the Adamic realms, the Garden Beautiful. It will not be easy for your understanding to imagine a whole environment being lowered, like a scene in a theatrical production, into contact with a much more material environment, yet such was the case. Of course, this transition took millions of years to complete and its manifestation would not have been visible to human sight. Perhaps the manifestation of human birth would be a good simile, for it was not accomplished without labor and was fraught with danger to the Adamic race. While the inhabitants of the Garden Beautiful were in their natural realm, nothing was hid from their eager questing minds, just as nothing had been hid from those spiritual beings who fell from grace. God hides nothing, but a growing intelligence is not able to assimilate all it encounters. The finite cannot encompass the infinite, yet all is there, awaiting a readiness to understand, a breadth of mind to conceive the undimensional perspective that the Creator employs. Ignorance holds no place in God's purpose, but just as your infants cannot absorb what is clear to the mature students, so the souls which are younger in experience cannot absorb the greater truths. So the instruction has to be given on a lower level, made more simple, and where it is enshrined in love, there can be few minds which cannot grasp the fundamentals of spiritual life, just as you have them in your Christian ethics. They are not new, for truth is ageless. Nevertheless, the true Atlanteans, the Adamic people, were accustomed to fourth-dimensional truths, yet they had to try and lower these into three-dimensional teaching for the benefit of the worldly-minded from the fallen race. The Adamic people were spiritually alert but were not skilled in manual dexterity like their darker neighbors, so it was they who provided the inspiration for the buildings and other forms of cultural expression, while the tribesmen provided the labor, glad to serve these lovely beings who were to them in the nature of gods. Slowly the great civilization was built up under the aegis of those who had brought with them the memory of their pristine life in the Garden Beautiful. In return, the indigenous inhabitants became their servants and tillers of the soil. Just as in the Garden Beautiful, celestial visitors used to manifest at the temples and guide the instruction, and these points of spiritual contact became seats of learning in matters long denied to our three-dimensional understanding. Despite their protests, images of these visitors were placed in the temples and elsewhere, and became focal points for psychic power, just as in the olden days of Lemuria. The Adamic people were a race of astrologers, taking the subject on a far higher and more spiritual level than we do. They knew something of the cosmic rays and interplanetary influences, and they knew how to blend and control these influences at the right season to benefit the crops. And they had some control over the atomic nature of matter. Some of your priests still bless the crops today, but that is supplication and not control. How is it that all record of such powers has been lost? Surely some knowledge of such incredible powers would have filtered through? You must remember what immense periods of time we are dealing with. Also, there was little writing at that time, except by the gifted few. There was little need for it because a permanent source of knowledge existed in the celestial visitors during their frequent appearances. Imagine that you had an atomic war that was worldwide and destroyed most of your records, and then suppose that 20,000 years later, when a new kind of civilization had been built up, that scientists began to unearth the prehistory of your day. What would they find of your knowledge from the fragments of your contemporary history dug up from the ruins? How would they assess the thinking of your day? How much would be ascribed to folklore and legend? AO to you Atlantis is but a lovely memory, most inadequately authenticated. In the most unlikely places in widely separated parts of the world you will find references to it, such as the Land of the Blessed, or the Golden Age. And thus it was, for it held men and women of great beauty of form and character, radiating divine love in a way that your intellectuals would find unacceptable.